The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Good morning, everyone. This is Andrew Locher from headquarters here in Edmond, Oklahoma. I'm filling in for Stephen Fleury, who is away from the studio today. We've been enjoying a very mild temperature spring so far this year. It's been pretty wet. The campus looks great. It's lush. The students have it manicured very well. If you've never visited our campus here in Edmond, it really is very impressive. We have over 160 acres of property. There's more than 170,000 square feet of living space, office space, classroom space, all of that together. We have water features, gardens. There's an agriculture program. We use 31 employees that work to take care of just the landscaping and maintenance, all of that under the direction of Mr. Wayne Turgeon. Those 31 employees are made up of 7 graduates and full-time staff. We have 11 college students who participate in landscaping and maintenance for their work program. And this summer, we have 11 teens from Imperial Academy that are working part-time to help maintain this beautiful campus. It has been stormy, and I've been pretty thankful for those storms. Our lakes have never been as filled as they are right now. And with youth camp coming up in 5 or 6 weeks, we have about 200 youth and volunteers that descend on campus to live God's way, to really grow spiritually. And it's all really enhanced when the campus looks as nice as it does. The ball fields are in fantastic condition, and it's just really been a tremendous spring. It has been stormy, as I said, though. This is a report from the local Fox television station. They said the average number of tornadoes in May for Oklahoma is 23. For 2019, Oklahoma has seen 83 tornadoes so far, with 43 in the Norman, Oklahoma forecast area, and that's where we reside. Says the average number of tornadoes for Oklahoma between January and May is 40. So the whole start of the year brings about 40 tornadoes, on average 23 just in the month of May. But this year, we've had more than twice as many, the average for the whole state, just here in our forecast area. We had one that came pretty close to campus just last week. It was closer to some of our members, as it turns out. But we dutifully evacuated down to the basement of the auditorium as the tornado was approaching, or what looked to be a tornado. It actually never touched down. There was no hail. But we did get some rain from that storm. And that rain that we've received, I think in a lot of ways you could say we are the envy of the southeastern United States, which is suffering through a very unseasonable heat and drought-like conditions. Now, we go to this prophecy frequently here on the program. It's found in Amos 4, verse 8, and I'm going to just grab bits and pieces from it. Again, you're familiar with this. Amos 4, verse 7 says, "And also I've withheld in the rain from you." He says, "I caused it to rain on one city and caused it not to rain on another." Verse 8, "So two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water, but they were not satisfied." God says, "You have yet not returned unto me." We haven't returned to God, even though we're suffering through these various trials and difficulties. We see some tremendous flooding, some horrific flooding. We see drought. We see storms. And yet God is saying, "Why don't you return to me?" God does hold absolute control over the weather, over the ongoings on this planet. Now, we have a tremendous booklet. It's entitled Why Natural Disasters. It's not a book about climate change. I guess in a sense it is, in that it mentions how wrong it is to attribute climate change to the weather upsets that we're seeing. The booklet says, notice, this is God speaking through his prophet Amos. He controls rainfall, causing floods and droughts. God causes these weather disasters. Now, that's hard for the average so-called Christian to accept, but that's exactly what the Bible says. In one region, God sends a drought. The booklet continues. In another region, floods. And it all happens right before the harvest time. The booklet then goes on to talk about the hurricanes from August 2017 that flooded the Houston area. Remember, they had about 50 inches of rain from those storms. And yet at the same time that 50 inches of rain fell in Houston, which is obviously not the normal, you went over to the West Coast and they were parched. There were fires that were burning millions of acres. And again, it's an exact fulfillment of what God said he would do through Amos. The booklet says this prophecy does more than tell us such disasters will occur. It tells us why they are occurring and how to prevent them from continuing. What a valuable piece of literature if mankind would only put it to the test. Now, we have so many Key of David programs, Trumpet Daily programs about the weather. They're all excellent teaching tools to help us understand prophecies in Amos and other places throughout the Bible. Dozens of articles and booklets to help us understand. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, there's terrible danger in blaming climate change alone and somehow believing that humanity or human beings can control the emission of greenhouse gases and somehow stop these curses. It might sound plausible to an intellectual mind, but I think if you think about it just a tiny little bit, you'll understand the fallacy of that. God prophesies that there will be blessings for obedience, and he also curses when there's unrepented of disobedience. God is a God of love. He's a God that wants to bless us. Again, you look at this campus. I'm going to give you an example here in just a moment, but it's rained a lot, no doubt. And some would argue more than what we should have. I love it. The lakes are filled. Everything is green and beautiful. In Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 12, God says, "The Eternal shall open unto you his good treasure, the heaven to give the rain unto your land in his season, and to bless all the work of your hand. And you shall lend to many nations, and you shall not borrow." I mean, God goes on and on to enumerate the blessings for obedience. That's what God respects, is obedience. Now, I want you to think about this story that I'll read to you here in just a moment, because there are also curses for disobedience. Verse 23 of that same chapter, Deuteronomy 28, "Your heaven that is over your head shall be brass, and the earth that is under you shall be as iron. The Eternal shall make the rain of your land powder and dust. From heaven shall it come down upon you until you be destroyed." Right? God, again, is trying to teach obedience.
There is not only the damage from that storm last night, but flooding across Oklahoma as well. Understand that some of the rivers have not even yet crested. With that, we bring in Republican Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, who is traveling near some of the flooding damage. Governor, appreciate you taking the time to be with us. It's often hard when you're not from the Midwest to understand the scope and the depth of the damage and what's happening. Is this normal storms in Oklahoma in the spring and early summer, or are we experiencing something far worse for you all?
Well, this year, the flooding for sure seems far worse than normal. We're approaching the 1986 flood. Muskogee is still peaking. We've got the Arkansas River that flows through Tulsa and then down through Muskogee. And it's just unbelievable, the damage there. We've had to evacuate a town. And then you throw the tornadoes on and El Reno.
Just so you understand, sir, we're putting some of the video that your office put up on the web of you touring some of that flooded damage. We can put that video back up. You talk us through what you saw from the helicopter, sir.
Yeah, so, you know, we've got the Arkansas River, and that's all meeting there at Muskogee, the Grand River, and you've got tremendous widespread damage over our farmland, some of the communities. We've been monitoring some of the dams along the river. Also, we've got a lock and dam system that we've been monitoring. I've got the National Guard out walking the levees to make sure that they're fine, and it's just unbelievable. We're hoping and praying that the rains will stop and this it'll crest finally today, and then we'll start getting on the other side of this.
Now, we have received so much blessing on this campus, and it's not to say we've been without damage. There's been a tiny little bit, but nothing like you see on the news, nothing that is just honestly a matter of miles from campus where you see some terrible flooding. But remember, God is the one who's in control, and mankind is not. This is a story from the Star-Telegram, a Texas paper from June 1st. The title is Texas Struggles to Keep Pace as Thirst for Water Intensifies. I think this is a remarkable statistic. It says about 1,000 people arrive in Texas each day, drawn by jobs, newly built homes, and other opportunities. But in a state where prolonged drought is a regular occurrence, officials are struggling to ensure they can satiate everyone's thirst. They said there are indications that the system is more fragile than once thought. And then a professor here from Texas State University said, the state is growing so fast that we're constantly playing catch-up when it comes to building resilient water supplies. The question is, when the bad times come, will there be enough water for everyone? And that really is the question. When the bad times come, how are we going to react? What will be our response? I like doing math, and I do like it when it rains, as you could probably tell from the start of this program. I did a few calculations. They estimate that 27,150 gallons is the amount of water for 1 inch of rain per acre. Now, we've had 14 and a half inches of rain so far in May, and so that equates to about 63 million gallons of water just on campus. That's the God that we serve. God can pour out in abundance and do so in a controlled manner. If you were to take the average number of gallons used per person per day and divide all this out, the amount of rain that we received on this 120 acres of campus just in the month of May is enough to sustain 1,950 people for an entire year. God can bless. God is in control. Now, the issues that our nation, in fact, the entire world, the problems that we face can only be addressed by turning to God. That you hear that all the time on this program. It requires personal obedience, national obedience, and by learning those lessons, God will teach us how to be blessed and happy. Well, enough talk about the weather. We'll take a short break now, and when I return, I'll have some Bible prophecy that's alive, that's exciting, and actually even ties back to what we just talked about.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical. But world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back. I'm sure you well remember King Nebuchadnezzar, his dream, the magnificent image. It's found in Daniel chapter 2. It's through this dream that God revealed the course of political history for mankind. It's a prophecy that looks forward to the establishment of a never-ending kingdom of God, a kingdom that's going to destroy and replace all governments and kingdoms of men. You remember this story, perhaps, how King Nebuchadnezzar had this troubling dream. He didn't understand what it meant, so he called the wise men of his council. He called the religious leaders, perhaps, together to have somebody tell him what his dream meant. But not only was he looking for an interpretation of the dream, he wanted to make sure that he could rely on the counsel or on the interpretation, the authority of the dream. And so he demanded that the wise people not only tell him what it meant, but actually what the dream was. Again, I think you're familiar with this. If not, you can read Daniel chapter 2. In that chapter, the young prophet Daniel came and told the king not only what his dream was, but also what it meant. And that interpretation gives us a tremendous framework for history since that point to the return of Jesus Christ. I'm going to read to you just a couple verses. Daniel chapter 2, verse 19 says, "Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision, and Daniel blessed the God of heaven." Verse 29, "He changes the times of the seasons." Daniel's talking about God, this mighty God. "He changes the times of the seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them who know understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him." This is the God that controls the planet, that controls rainfall. He's also very much involved in political affairs to guide them and shape them so that it fulfills his plan and his purpose. God is the one that decides political affairs. Now, some might argue that God is biased, or perhaps they'd accuse him of playing favorites. That's contrary to what the Bible teaches. Read it for yourself. Acts chapter 10 and verse 34 tells us God is not a respecter of persons. Believe the Bible for what it says, but I think as we go through things here, you'll see that God is working out a purpose, not for the benefit of one nation or one people in particular, but for the whole creation. Now, think about this passage as we carry on through the rest of today's program. It's in Romans chapter 9, and there's quite a few verses here. I just want to read these to you to give you some context. Romans chapter 9 and verse 10 says, "Not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, even by our father Isaac," verse 11, "for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or any evil, that the purpose of God, according to election, might stand, not of works, but of him that calls, it was said unto her, the elder shall serve the younger." So we're talking about Jacob and Esau. And as Paul is telling the Romans, before they were even born, before they had any works, God had purposed to have the elder serve the younger brother. Verse 13, "As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God?" Paul says, "God forbid." Verse 15, "For he said to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then it is not of him that wills, nor of him that runs, but of God that shows mercy." God is the one that determines these things. Consider this example, verse 17. "For the scripture says unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth." So God set up Pharaoh, who enslaved what God would later call his people. God set him up for a purpose, that I might show my power in you. Verse 18, "Therefore has he mercy upon whom he will have mercy, and whom he will harden. You will say then unto me, why does he yet find fault? For who has resisted his will?" Verse 20, "Nay, but O man, who are you that replies against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why have you made me thus? Has not the potter power over the clay, or the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor?" God's point is, I'm working out a plan here. It's a plan that exceeds the lifetime of an average man. In fact, God is working with millennia of history. God is the one that controls political affairs, and God says, I don't need to be questioned by puny man. Who are you that replies against God? Verse 22 says, "What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endures with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction?" and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he has afore prepared unto glory. Paul says in verse 24, even us, whom he has called not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. Now, I encourage you to study this whole chapter, Romans chapter 9. I think you understand the point I'm trying to make here. God says, I set up the pieces on the table. I'm the one that's moving them. It's not up to the pieces to tell me how to do things because you don't understand. God is working out a purpose for the benefit of all mankind. We just went through the Passover where God proved that love and gave his only begotten Son for all men. God needs us to see things from his perspective. Now, if you want a truly interesting Bible study, you need to go through Genesis chapter 49. And there you'll find clues from God that he gives through Moses about how to identify nations of Israel in this end time through prophecy. Now, we have, again, resources available on thetrumpet.com. If you go and search, if you use the Literature Library tab, I could tell you, if you just go to the United States and Britain in prophecy, in particular for this study, you'll learn so much. Genesis chapter 49 and verse 1. It says, and Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. It's a prophecy from God. Jacob is talking to his 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob's name later changed to Israel, as you know. Now, Bible scholars probably would never turn to Genesis to understand prophecy, but we know the entire Bible is necessary if we're going to understand what God is doing. Let's get God's perspective. Let's recognize an event or two, as we will in this program, to just really better appreciate our God who uses nations to show his glory. It is God's prerogative, after all, and he's doing so for the betterment of all of mankind. So what does the Bible teach us to look for in these latter days? Well, for the sake of time, I'm going to presuppose or presume that there's a base level of understanding with our audience. Verse 3 of Genesis 49 says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. Verse 4 says, unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then defiled you it. He went up to my couch. Reuben here is the firstborn, as it said. Reuben is modern-day France, and they factor into the remaining segment of this program, as you'll see in just a moment. Now, notice some of the national tendencies God uses to identify Reuben or France in these latter days, and think if this holds true. They would have traits of dignity and power. I don't think anybody would argue that. However, they would be unstable. Though blessed with that dignity, the culture, the civility, though blessed with power, they would never really rise to the top, even though they were the firstborn. That's essentially what God is teaching us there through those two verses in Genesis 49. In a different account, this is found over in Genesis chapter 37. We won't take time to go there, but you'll probably remember Joseph was favored by his father, and it was much to the chagrin of the other brothers. And the plan was to get rid of Joseph. Now, Joseph, in this case, and you probably know this from listening to this program, Joseph is the prophetic father of Ephraim and Manasseh, or Britain and America. And so the plan was to get rid of Britain and America. The betrayal that was suggested by Reuben was worked in conjunction with the other brothers. But in this betrayal, Reuben suggested a plan to deceive his father. And Judah then added a financial motive to the entire plan. Again, you can look at that later on your own. I think you remember they put him in a pit, and Joseph was later taken away captive. Going back to Genesis 49, though, Let's look at the description of another nation. Genesis 49, verse 8. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you are gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? Now, we typically go on to read verse 10, which is very important, which we will do later on. But I want to focus on an event in history that ties back to this prophetic trait of Judah, that also brings in Reuben. It also brings in Ephraim and Manasseh. And it helps us understand what God is doing. Judah, a lion's whelp. Judah is modern-day Israel as we know it, the tiny nation in the Middle East. A lion's whelp, a fierce young lion. The same Hebrew word is used in Amos chapter 3, verse 4. And it says there, will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Will a young lion cry out of his den if he has taken nothing? Lions, as you know, are cunning, one of the most ferocious beasts on the planet. Surely, it's an animal you don't want to tangle with. It's an animal that has reputation, you could say. Now, when you think of Judah as a lion, in my mind, it makes me think of all the conquests, the military confrontation that modern-day Israel has had. You have to be impressed with their strength, with their success. If you look at their current environment, surrounded by enemies that outnumber them, that really could wreak a lot of havoc, somehow, some way, Judah survives. Which attack, which confrontation, which war or mission of the Israelis is the most memorable? Well, there's quite a few. The 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Maybe you're thinking of 1956 with the Suez Crisis. In 1967, the Jews fought the Six-Day War. Maybe 1973, Yom Kippur War. 1976, the raid on Entebbe, as we've talked about on this program. All of these different battles come to mind, and all of them with miraculous intervention. God fighting on behalf of Israel. Who are the players in the world to question how God is doing things or why God is doing things? God uses nations, as he says in Romans chapter 9, to declare his name, to fulfill his purpose. Well, June 7th, 2019 marks the 38-year anniversary of Operation Opera, or it's also known as Operation Babylon. And maybe that didn't initially come to mind because we probably don't think of the mission name so much. But you'll remember the story as I go through this. It was an Israeli Air Force miracle, really. A surprise attack by the Air Force against the Osirak nuclear reactor that was about 18 miles south of Iraq. Military analysts would likely put this in their top 10 most daring, most improbable, yet tremendously successful military raids of the past 100 years. It was a mission to save Israel. Let me give you a little background. And in doing so, I might suggest to you a book and a short documentary video if you don't have time to read, but I'd encourage you to read the book. It's entitled Raid on the Sun. It's a well-written book. It's packed with really interesting history. The first part of the book really goes into a lot of detail about the rise of Saddam Hussein. It highlights and documents the pursuit of weapons of mass destruction throughout the Middle East. The author's name is Roger Clare. And the book is pretty unique. And the reason why I picked it is he interviewed all 8 Israeli Air Force pilots that participated in this raid. He had exclusive cooperation, as it says on the booklet cover, exclusive cooperation from the high command of Israel's Air Force. And as the book points out, a lot of these details have just recently been declassified. Now, there's a video that was produced by the Military Channel. You can find it on YouTube. It's entitled Raid on the Iraqi Reactor. Again, it's a short video, about 45 minutes, and they actually interview the author of the book that I just referenced. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was obviously rich with oil money, but they were poor on technology, and they needed something to tilt the balance. The Iraqis approached Jacques Chirac, the prime minister of France, or Reuben, at that time. They approached him about purchasing a nuclear reactor. They didn't have the wherewithal to manufacture and build their own nuclear reactor, and so they approached the French. The Iraqis had tremendous oil reserves, so much more than they could really ever use. They didn't need a nuclear reactor. It's laughable to look back at the history and look at some of the reasoning that the French offered and that the Iraqis offered about wanting to turn to nuclear power. They were sitting on oil reserves vast beyond what they could really ever use. For decades, Saddam ruled with an iron fist of violence against even his own people. And what I found interesting in this book was the story of Saddam, who dreamed of recreating Nebuchadnezzar's empire by defeating all the Arabs and the Jews around him. That's the way he looked at King Nebuchadnezzar. If you remember back to Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. I mean, he was the prime one. And Saddam Hussein looked at that example, and that's what he sought to recreate. He wanted to do so through military conquest, but also by using his wealth and building this society or civilization that replicated what King Nebuchadnezzar had. Now, Saddam Hussein appealed to the Russians first, and they delivered to him an old reactor. It was an experimental reactor. It was undersized. It was never capable of producing enough enriched uranium that could later be turned chemically into plutonium. But they sold it to him with the promise that you could have this nuclear reactor. And they took advantage of a nuclear ignorant nation, a nation that had a lot of money and a desire to conquer the world. Well, it proved to be frustrating, humiliating to Saddam, and that's what ultimately pushed him to Reuben, or France, with a financial offer that they just couldn't refuse. In 1975, the French made a public statement that they had entered into this contract with Iraq to deliver them a nuclear reactor capable of producing enough weapons-grade uranium to produce weapons. Now, they didn't frame it that way. They talked about the power output, the learning capacity of their first reactor. That was what they told the public. Here, France, or Reuben, once again betraying their prophetic brothers, Britain, America, but especially Israel or Judah. Saddam paid $300 million to the French for this reactor. It was on sale, or it was listed for $150 million. So he offered twice the asking price. They also purchased other military equipment, automobiles, other goods, everything to sweeten the deal. And Saddam had a penchant for accelerating delivery times. Really, it's a fascinating book. There's so much that I didn't understand. And it does give you quite a background understanding for the later conflict between the Iraqis and the Americans and their coalition. Now, Saddam named the reactor after the Babylonian month Tammuz. Tammuz is, I think, the equivalent of July, if I'm not mistaken. And that's the month that King Nebuchadnezzar began his attack against Judah in 586 BC. Now, what's interesting when studying this history is the ignorance, perhaps, or at least it seems that way to me, of the more sophisticated world from really understanding what was going on. But as I'll talk about, the Western world and the Soviet Union at the time, they were distracted with their own projects. Saddam Hussein later named the reactor Asirak, to include the pagan god name Osiris. Osiris is the Egyptian god of the underworld, and then he worked in the name Iraq. So Osirak, this reactor. Again, he's naming it for his intention of how he intends to use it. It was a tool. It was a means to destroy Judah. It was a tool to conquer the Arab world. And amazingly, as I said, this construction project went on for years, and its aim of developing enough weapons-grade uranium carried on with insufficient concern by the United States, Europe, and even Russia. Money was at play. The United States had a weak president, presidential administration in office through Jimmy Carter. This is 1977 through 1981, as history was marching forward. Iran and Iraq were fighting a prolonged war of attrition among themselves. The superpowers, while they were profiting from weapon sales to both sides, they were trying to leverage influence in the oil-rich area of the world here in the Middle East. And so with all of this distraction going on, so too was construction of a nuclear reactor, where the violent dictator of that nation had obvious intention to build weapons of mass destruction to use primarily against Judah. Menachem Begin, Prime Minister of Israel at the time, was very concerned about the prospect of an Arab nuclear weapon. Now, ironically, the French sold Israel a reactor that was installed in Dimona about a decade earlier. The Israelis were already manufacturing weapons themselves from the nuclear byproducts of this reactor. And so that story, oven by itself, is very interesting. So you see everything building in the Middle East. All of it building around Judah. God is not a respecter of persons, but God does everything for a purpose. Well, the Israelis tried diplomacy. The United States refused to take action themselves. So the Israelis worked out several different scenarios. First, they would try to use the Mossad to disrupt the construction. They would continue to use diplomacy, but they understood that at some point, before the reactor went hot, before it was fueled with the uranium, that something needed to stop that process. They created this very intricate and wonderful military plan to fly over the barren desert of Saudi Arabia to get through Iraqi airspace. They fly directly to Baghdad, drop their bombs. First, though, as I said, they tried these clandestine missions. I'll play to you an audio clip from that YouTube video that comes here, clip one.
Over the course of the development of the reactor, various news agencies reported that nearly a dozen nuclear scientists working on the project lost their lives. Many of the deaths were blamed on the Mossad.
There were some successes all the way. I cannot refer to details, but it's been done.
Despite the espionage, the murders, the sabotage, it was clear to the Israelis that nothing was going to stop Saddam from completing the construction of the reactor.
So even though they had measured success there, it wasn't enough to stop the program. Just for sake of time, I'll give you some of the miraculous details of this bombing mission. And again, I think as you've seen with other battles that we've drawn attention to, you can see God's hand involved. It proves exactly what he says in Daniel chapter 2, that he sets kings and he takes down kings. Romans chapter 9 tells us the same story. This attack, Operation Babylon or Operation Opera, was the world's first airstrike against a nuclear plant. That's pretty bold. The Israelis learned from the failed U.S. mission to free its hostages from Iran that a ground operation to stop this construction phase was just simply too dangerous, right? It was during that period of time that the United States suffered an embarrassing military failure to free the hostages. due to the Iranian Revolution, which it deposed the Shah of Iran again. We've talked about that. There were dozens of modern F-16 fighters that had been sold to Iran. They were built, but they had not yet been delivered. They were due to be delivered to the Shah. But thanks to this revolution, the United States stopped the delivery of, I believe it was over 70 of these advanced fighter jets. The United States didn't want to sit on that inventory. They sold them to Israel instead. And think about how advantageous that is to this day. What if those 76 F-16s had been delivered to Iran? What kind of world would we live in today? Well, the Israelis purchased the jets. They got these brand new, highly advanced fighters. But there was a problem. The mission range for the aircraft was only adequate for about, I think, half to three quarters of the miles they needed to fly. The Israeli Air Force needed to fly over 1,200 miles to bomb the reactor. That was the round trip distance that they had to fly. And so they outfitted these F-16s, these brand new F-16s, with more external fuel capacity than they were designed to hold, about twice as much, if I'm not mistaken. Military analysts, if you read the newspaper stories in the days that followed the attack, the military analysts did not attribute the F-16 to this attack because simply it was inadequate for this mission. It wasn't capable of carrying out successfully what they did. I mean, they could have flown there and dropped the bombs but not returned home according to the specs of the aircraft. As I mentioned, they flew over 600 miles each way, and they did so under 100 feet of altitude. So it was very stressful, very exhausting, flying that low, that close to the ground. They flew in pairs. So there were four pairs of F-16s. They were separated by 3 seconds worth of distance. When they left, and this is, I think, one of the more interesting points of this whole mission. When they departed Israel, they flew south over the Gulf of Aqaba. And as they were flying over the Gulf of Aqaba, they flew over a very large, very fancy yacht. As it turns out, Jordanian King Hussein was on that yacht. He was the owner of the yacht. Now, King Hussein himself is a pilot, and he recognized the Israeli F-16s. He saw that they had extra fuel tanks and weapons, and he quickly surmised that they were flying on a bombing mission against Baghdad. He figured all that out just by the direction they were flying. And so he called ahead to Baghdad, but his message never got through to the right people. How many times do we hear these stories of what mankind might call fate or luck? And yet it's all by design of God. The Israelis bombed the reactor on a Sunday to avoid casualties. Israel seems to always have had that history, at least modern-day Israel, of being concerned about collateral damage, civilian injury or death. And so they flew on a Sunday to avoid those casualties. There were still French technicians installing the reactor. And yet, by the time the mission was completed, not one civilian was killed by Israeli weapons, at least the way that they attributed all the damage. Those that did die, and it was a very small number of people that died, mostly died from the anti-aircraft gunfire that the Iraqis shot into the air indiscriminately trying to hit the Israeli jets. Well, what you shoot up comes down, and that killed some of their own people. The Israelis timed the flight and the attack to the change of the guard, and so there was very few military men there present at the time. All the AAA guns, all the anti-aircraft artillery, everybody was at break. It was dinner time. They were changing guard. Nobody was manning their posts like they ought to have been doing that. And so when the jets came in and climbed up to altitude to dive bomb the target, there was no response. It was confusing to the Israeli pilots, as you read their account, because they expected to be lucky to release their weapons. And yet there was no fire, at least at the first pair that came in. Unbeknownst to the Israelis and really unexplained, the radars, the anti-aircraft radars that were installed close to the reactor, those were all turned off. There were no Iraqi fighters up in the air flying over Baghdad. All of those circumstances led to a tremendously successful bombing raid. All the bombs hit their targets. There was very little collateral damage. I think all but two of the 16 bombs that were dropped exploded on target. What's interesting about all this, and again, this is on June 7th. That's why I bring it up. This is 38 years ago in history. Sadly, though, as the Israelis were so successful in this mission, the world condemned the attack, including the other nations of end time Israel. The American leadership was against what the Israelis did. All of them, the whole cabinet of President Reagan's cabinet was against it, except for one member. George H.W. Bush was the vice president at the time. He was especially critical of the Israelis. He wanted punitive action against them. And the United Nations pursued that punitive action. The condemnation was very stout against Judah. And yet at the end, President Ronald Reagan really never punished the Israelis. Now, in retaliation for the Israeli attack, the French, Reuben, Jacques Chirac, publicly disclosed the fact that the Israelis themselves had a nuclear program that included weapons development. Up to this point, it was an unconfirmed rumor. For 10 years, the Israelis had kept that project secret. And Reuben disclosed the fact that the Israelis, in their minds, were hypocritical, not allowing the Iraqis to have nuclear weapons while they themselves were developing them. Now, again, I want you to think just for a moment of the consequences had Israel not taken this action. This was 10 years before Operation Desert Storm. The Osirak reactor would have produced enough material for two or three nuclear bombs per year. They had 10 years to operate if the Israelis had not taken out the reactor. That's a lot of nuclear weapons that could have been used against the coalition forces and Israel. I want to play to you another audio clip from Alexander Haig. He was the Secretary of State in the United States at the time of this Israeli attack. Clip two.
Then we finally got around to me, and I said to the president, before this is over, we'll be on our knees thanking God Israel did what it did.
Now, you know the Israelis were successful, and as Mr. Haig said, really, the nations of end time Israel, in fact, the whole world, should be thanking God. But mankind doesn't seem to learn from history all that well. You know, the Israelis had to bomb another reactor about 25 years later, this time on September 6, 2007, Operation Outside the Box. And this destroyed a reactor in Syria. Again, the United States and Britain and even France, the rest of the world, were against this military strike. This time it was a North Korean reactor that was destroyed. And again, the military details are quite amazing. They didn't launch this major offensive. Again, it was eight aircraft, four F-15s and four F-16s. Really quite an attack on Syria. I just want to read you quickly a few details before we run out of time here. These are comments from senior U.S. administration officials about the lead up to this attack against Syria. President George W. Bush told Ehud Olmert on June 19, 2007, that there was no justification for a U.S. strike on the reactor. Robert Gates was the Secretary of Defense. He said military strike should be left to the Israel since the U.S. public was tired of adventures in Asia. No will, no backbone to stop this attack. Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, urged diplomacy. She was not convinced that Israel could, quote, deliver the goods. But there was one administration official that was all for it, Dick Cheney. He said, he believed the U.S. should attack and destroy the reactor to deter other countries from pursuing clandestine nuclear programs. So the Israelis once again flew their mission, took out this reactor in Syria, and Olmert called President Bush afterward, and President Bush simply said, Very good. Now, lastly, I'll just remind you the consequences again to the United States, to the coalition forces, had the Syrians been allowed to develop nuclear weapons. You see, the Lion of Judah, they prevented mankind from descending into nuclear conflict a few times that we know of, and that has given time for prophecy to be fulfilled. I encourage you again to think of all of this in the context of Daniel chapter 2 and Romans chapter 9. The history of man really is more about the history of God and God's plan. Two final scriptures that are relevant that help us understand why it's critical for Judah to survive to this day and the honor that they're going to have coming their way in the immediate future. From Hosea chapter 11 and verse 12, it says, "Ephraim compasses me about with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit, but Judah yet rules with God and is faithful with the saints." God's work, you could say, is God's mouthpiece. It's God's voice in these very chaotic times. God uses Judah to be faithful and to protect his saints right through these last days. Judah, or modern-day Israel, will show favor to God's church as we move forward through very risky times. And quite honestly, I can't think of another tribe of Israel that I'd rather have providing that cooperation and protection. But as we know, all of this history of mankind, all of it is building. Jeremiah likened it to a boiling pot. We know it's all building to the return of Jesus Christ. In that same minor prophet book, Hosea 5 and verse 5, it tells us that the United States, Britain, and even Judah will all fall together, leading to the tribulation. Now, there's good news in that. God doesn't favor individuals, but God is interested in that fifth kingdom, his kingdom, that will rule with peace. Man's 6,000 years of failed rule over himself is coming to an end. And there is a kingdom coming that brings peace, not only to the Middle East, but to the entire world. God is using this church, this program, to prepare the world for the return of Christ and the establishment of that kingdom. Our final verse is in Genesis 49, where we read about Judah, Reuben. Genesis 49, verse 10 says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, or a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." God is establishing kingly rule through Judah. God is reinforcing the rule of law through Judah. All of that until Christ comes, and then the gathering of all people. Now, that's the greatest possible news. Christ shall soon return and use that scepter to bring peace. What great understanding we have, thanks to history, thanks to prophecy. Well, I hope you have a great day. And don't forget to really use your Bible to study history and all that we have to offer you here on KPCG, and prepare yourself for these very momentous times just ahead.